This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two people that I love to talk to, Kate Scotchless.
Hello.
And Tia Vasiliou.
Hello.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm really excited about this week's topic, if only because Tia told us before we started recording that she actually did research, so that's super exciting. And also because I read so many comic books this week, I am bursting at the seams with just comic book stuff. So before that happens, though, I want to toss it over to Tia and Kate and ask you, how have your weeks been? And how have comic books been? Also, what did you read this week? You know,
I managed to read a few things in between watching the Olympics.
Oh, in case you haven't been following Twitter or Tia on Twitter, she has been live tweeting all the gymnastics Olympic stuff. So in case you missed any of that, she's got a whole live feed of that you can catch up on. Continue.
Yes, no, I did end up sparing Twitter the rhythmic gymnastics and took that to Tumblr because some people were just like, Tia, what the hell?
I had Twitter notifications on for you, and then I had to turn them off.
Yeah.
Just want to let you know.
If you're still with me on Twitter, then you win a gold medal. Okay. Yay. So anyway, I did read a few things. Black Widow number 6, which, you know, this was a sort of Civil War II tie-in, which I wasn't mad about because, as you all know, I'm not hating Civil War II. And this book continues to be gorgeous. I think that Matt Wilson needs to win all the Eisners and run for president because he just is brilliant.
I would support that campaign.
The world would be a better place, I'm just saying. And I also read Spider-Woman number 10, also kind of a Civil War tie-in. But, you know, what I thought was really interesting about this is, you know, Jessica and Carol have been really close friends for a while in the comics. And I don't necessarily think that this is going to like end their friendship, but it's definitely a source of conflict. And it was really interesting. And the layout of this book and the art, the visual storytelling continues to be spectacular. So, yay, Spider-Woman. Keeping in my theme of Civil War tie-ins with badass Marvel ladies, yes, Mockingbird number 6, which was, as you know, the first five have been, beautiful and hilarious and touching and just so, so good. I mean, Bobby is Hawkeye's ex-wife, and so she has some opinions and feelings about what's going on in the main Civil War storyline. And so she's like also kind of trying to decompress a little bit. So she goes on this crazy cruise. And Chelsea Kane is a great writer. It's so good.
Totally.
Yeah. My big you one. Know, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Just on that book, because I don't have this listed as what I read. I did read it this week. I totally forgot about the whole Hawkeye debacle in Civil War II, so I was like, why is it such a big deal that Hawkeye's not on this cruise? Spoilers, there's like a cruise dedicated to superhero stuff, and Hawkeye was supposed to be the guest speaker, except for he's in jail. But I was like, what's such a big deal? Like, I knew these two were married, and then like halfway through the issue, I like slapped myself in the face. Because everything else was just so intriguing. She like Bobby mentions it, like, just kind of off the cuff. She's just like, oh, well, of course he's not here. And I was like, well, yeah, because he's Hawkeye. And then, of course, I realized, oh, no, there's actually something bigger going on here. So, yeah, I have to credit Chelsea Kane. That book just makes me laugh out loud.
I love it so much. And, you know, the art is really great, too. Oh, my God, Kate Niemczak. I know I'm saying her name wrong, and I'm sorry for that. But it's really, really good. I like following her on Tumblr. She posts a lot of good art there, too. And speaking of Tumblr and good art and other wonderful things, The Wicked and the Divine, number 22, the finale of the Rising Action arc was wow. It was wow.
That's all I can say. Yep.
Divine Anarchy, all caps, is my response to this book. I don't know, Mike. Tell me how spoilery we can get here. I don't want to ruin it for people.
Don't ruin it. Don't. Yeah, as I say, don't ruin it. But I have to say is I thought this was going to be the end of the book. the way that this issue ended, I was like, that's the end of the series, right? So take that as you will, Kate. Okay. But yeah, that just the way that it ended, I was like just totally bonkers.
It's
lost.
Yeah. It's been a really fighty arc, and Persephone has been kicking ass and taking names, and basically, like, just more of that, exponentially more fighty and ass-kicky.
Yeah, there was one panel in particular in this issue that was above and beyond the reach that I thought that Matt Wilson and Jamie McKelvey could accomplish together. I don't want to describe the panel at all because it's the spoiler panel, but just looking, looking at this page, it was so detailed, so intricate, like the amount of work that must have gone into just that one, because it's like a full page spread or like a one page spread, but it's like, it was so intricate. Like I just spent time because I was reading it on my iPad, just like zooming and just looking at all the fine details. It was amazing, just amazing.
And, you know, it was such a spectacular conclusion. I think that it's easy to overlook some of the smaller great things that happened in the issue. Like, I really hope that Amaterasu and Cassandra strike up a little more of a friendship, especially after their fight slash heart to heart that happened in the Amaterasu issue of Commercial Suicide. And then like, you know, when she's in trouble, she immediately goes to Cassandra. And, you know, I think that it would be nice to have an example in this book of characters who are at odds who like learn how to be friends.
Totally. Totally. So Kate, how are things for you and how have comic books been?
Good. It's been a very Tom King heavy reading week for me. I had picked up Sheriff of Babylon Volume 1, which I really enjoyed, although I definitely need to sit down and reread it like all in one go, because I think I don't think I could give you a very accurate plot summary.
Okay.
There's a lot going on.
Does it read more like a novel or something?
No,
or is it just...
it's definitely a comic, but it's really intricate of, you know, double-crossing and different motives, you know, that kind of thing with all these different characters. And it's
okay.
So it's Iraq in 2004, and it follows our main character is part of the military police training the Iraqi police to take over, basically. And then one of the trainees gets murdered, and he takes it upon himself to figure out who did it and yada yada. And of course the whole place is in shambles and everyone's has different motives and alignments and stuff. The art, Mitch, it's, okay, I'm going to maybe mispronounce this, but Mitch Gerads, I don't know. Anyway, his art is beyond gorgeous. He does a really, really nice job, which is not what you kind of expect going into what is, you know, a lot of tan and gray kind of world when you're in the Middle East like that for this kind of war-torn place. But he does a really amazing job with the light and how it works in these different environments, and it's very nice, and he does it all digitally, which I think is interesting. It's in the trade you get all these extra pages, right? And it shows his process of how he does the entire thing on the computer. I also read All-Star Batman. Oh wait, no, that's not King. Batman 3-5 is what was King.
Yeah.
And yeah, his writing on this one is not up to par, in my humble opinion, with his work on Sheriff of Babylon or Vision. I am not as happy with this. I mean, it's not bad. It's just not like the amazing, I have to tell all my friends about it, that Vision is, which is what I was hoping it would be. I also read Vision number 10, which is my perfect baby, but it's almost done. We only have 2 more issues because it's ending at 12. And then I checked out All-Star Batman number 1 because I don't think I'm going to keep going with the main Batman line. So I checked out, it's Tom King. Trust me. I was more surprised than anybody, but
that's fine. That's fine.
Finch's art is just not for me. I've tried.
But
tried
he's
hard.
Done after this arc.
What?
He's done after this arc.
Tell
yeah.
Me
that's,
more.
That's the whole big, so I know Nick is going to get on my case about this cause I'm sure I got something wrong here, but,
okay.
What's supposed to happen is they do one artist for the first arc, and then they're bringing out a different artist because they're pumping out the issues so quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the artists don't have time to catch up. So I think after this first arc, they're changing to someone else. I don't know who the first person or the next person is. I know that it's announced. I just don't know it off the top of my
head. Well, then I rescind my decision. Finch's art,
yeah, yeah.
I may or may not keep going, depending on who it is. Because with the combination of the slightly underwhelming for me, I'm sure. I know other people are super into it. Writing with the art that I just really don't like has been kind of a buzzkill, but. If it's a different person, maybe. And then maybe he's getting his stride. Anyway. So I checked out All-Star Batman, Snyder's book, and I like that one a lot more. I really like the art on it. Something Jr. Help me out here. Ramita Jr.
Oh, John Ramita
That's
Jr.
That's the one. I liked his work on it. And then
the backup story was Declan Shelby.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a little... So I was reading it in digital and was a little confused. I'm like... that it's a new story starting, and I'm like, wait a minute, and then had to flip back, and it made more sense. But I like that one a lot. It gets very time-hoppy, intricate, the way that Snyder likes to do sometimes. But I thought it worked really nicely. And then I read Black Hammer number 2, which is Lee Myers' title with Dark Horse, I believe. And I'm really liking that one. And I read... about a third of Pretty in Ink, North American Women Cartoonist, by Trina Robbins, which is a nonfiction book, obviously, about the history of women cartoonists. And so I'm up to, the 1920s, 1930s, and the key thing I've learned so far is that these women were bosses. Like, a whole bunch of them started their careers when they were, 14 or 15 in a completely male-dominated field, which, it turns out, wasn't that bad as long as they were writing comics for women and children that were completely non-threatening to men. But
the
then,
thing that the men didn't want to do,
right?
Or something,
exactly.
Right?
That it makes sense that these girls are writing for women, kind of thing. And they were in all women publication type things, like Ladies' Home Journal and stuff. But then, as soon as you start seeing women writing more action and adventure type titles. Then that's when they have to start sending everything in by mail and not going in person and using their first initial or changing their name to sound like a man's name kind of thing to try and get around, because they just straight wouldn't hire people that were female for it. Why would men want to read a lady comic?
And also though, how cool would it be if you could still read comics in women focused publications?
Right?
Like,
I know,
you know, I would love to pick up Cosmo or Vogue. I would if it had comics in it, maybe not in their current states, but I don't know. I also have read that book. I could probably do with a reread, but I got the sense that women in the earlier eras before the comics code and all of the what you're talking about, mm-hmm. Kate, they had an opportunity to be a little bit more subversive, and it was
so
cool. So
many of them were really, really active with the suffrage movement.
Yeah, yeah. Great book.
Yep.
Yeah, we're also reading that for our book club on Goodreads, so you should read that for the month of August and then jump on Goodreads and talk to us about that, so let me just plug that right there. I have yet to start it because I'm a bag of shit.
Hold on, Mike, you're not, because this is our separate from the book of the month. It's the nonfiction pick.
This is true.
So it's
this
going for, I think, through October. We gave ourselves a long time
you're right.
To read it, because it, I just started because I waited forever to get it from the library. With the interlibrary loan system, it worked out, and... For anyone who's hemming and hawing about paying the if they're just straight out buying it, I think I'm going to. It's really good. It's totally worth, I think, $35 is the cover point.
I think that people need to understand that the reason books like this can be a little bit more expensive is because it can sometimes cost more to acquire the rights to publish the images.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just keep that in mind. They're not just being give us all your money. It literally is more expensive to make these books.
This author must have spent years doing the research for this, because back in the day, women, and even if they were successful before they got married, they didn't keep using their maiden name. So a lot of these women went under four or five different pen names, depending on what publication and what era, if they were trying to use just initials, and then they got married, and now they're using a different last name, and then they get divorced, and then they get remarried, so figuring out who's who. There's even she talked about how there's a lot of confusion with people thinking, this and this alias are the same person when actually it's two different, and then this and this, which people think are two separate, are actually the same, and so it gets really muddy with continuity and who's doing what. So
interesting.
Yeah,
I definitely need to sit down and just start reading it. If I put myself like one chapter in, I'm certain that I'm just going to push through the rest of the book. So maybe I'll do that next week instead of doing what I did this weekend, which was I read so much manga it's not even funny. So for this book club that I run at in my office, we're reading a bunch of shonen manga, which is like young boys action oriented manga. So I sat down and I read One Piece Volume 1, Naruto Volume 1, Bleach Volume 1, Dragon Ball Z Volume 1, which is technically like Dragon Ball Volume 17 or 18 or something like that. But I started with Dragon Ball Z because that's what I'm most familiar with. And then I read this, I continued reading a series that I've been reading for a little while called Bakuman. I read Volume 3 this weekend. So I have, everything is just in black and white and it goes from, you know, right to left. And it's, I'm so confused, so that when I started reading, you know, regular comics this morning before the show, I was like, what is even happening? Of course, I'm reading these all digitally, so like swiping the wrong direction and getting the notification, hey, Mike, you're doing this wrong, was great. But I also read Uncanny X-Men number 11 and number 12, Uncanny X-Men number 11, All New X-Men number 12, and there's really nothing special to say about these books. They're kind of in the blah period that X-Men books get into sometimes. I read Wicked and Divine number 22, but T and I already talked about that. I read The Black Monday Murders number 1, and this is another one of those Hickman books that I think I'm going to have to trade weight this. There's way too many pieces going on, and as much as I like the magical element of the story, the whole tracing all the economic weirdness of the characters and what's happening is almost too much to hold on to, especially just in one issue, so I'm going to wait on that. But it was very good. Like, it was some top-notch John Hickman, Nightly News level, dark storylines that's basically giving a big fuck you to somebody, so that's always good. I also read Ringside number 6, which had a little bit more wrestling, and Paul mentioned that in last week's episode, had a little more wrestling, but a little more murder stuff, and revenge story, so I don't know. This book is weird, but I love it. I can't, like, after I finished the issue, I was like, I remember why I really liked this book in the first place, even though it's not about as much wrestling as I want it to be. But the two big things that I want to talk about are Black Hammer number 2, which I'm just loving to death. Like, Jeff Lemire's writing is like super top notch, and all I can think of is he wanted to write a Justice League story, but someone told him no, so he's like, all right, I'm just gonna make analog characters. That's right. And screw everyone. The best part about this issue was that there were thought bubbles. He used thought bubbles in the way that thought bubbles are supposed to be used in the quote-unquote golden age. And the story has this whole inner thing where they flash back to the quote-unquote golden age of these superheroes in the story, and he uses the thought bubbles in such a natural way. Like, he could have used captions, but that would have diminished the feeling of the golden age. So I have to credit him for that. Like, that was, we just had that issue a little, or that episode a couple, like, I don't know, maybe a month or two back, 3 months back, talking about thought bubbles and how they're not used anymore. And I don't know, like, Jeff Lemire, he just, like, nailed it. He totally took it and said, it is still possible. So I have to credit him for that. And then last night, after all the manga that I read, I stayed up until 4 in the morning, and I was like, I gotta get some Western comics in before I go to sleep. And I read Batman Volume 1, Court of Owls, whatever it's called, which is the Scott Snyder run that started the New 52, and I'm hooked now. Now I'm in it. Now I gotta keep reading. I know. I was 4 in the morning. I sent him a text message. I was like, man, I started it. And then, of course, a half hour later, like, Nick's still up at 4:30 in the morning. He's like, all right, thumbs up, like 5 thumbs up. So now I'm going to be talking about that on and off for the next couple of months. So sorry, everyone. I'm rehashing the New 52. Like it or not, that's what I'm going to be talking about. very excited about this. It was so cool. Like, I don't even know half the stuff that they were talking about, but it's just an exciting, like, deeper dive into the history of Gotham, and for some reason that seems really cool to me.
Yeah, I love volumes 1 and 2 of that run.
Yeah, see, I'm, you know, the funny thing is I actually read the Death of the Family arc, like, independently, mm-hmm. because I was really interested in the story, and I really, really liked it. But from everybody else that I've talked to who's read the Batman story from beginning to end, they're like, that was the worst arc of all of them. So I'm really excited to see how this all plays out, because that means that Zero Year and Bloom and all this other crazy stuff must be really, really good if they're saying Death of the Family is bad. But anyways, enough about Batman. We did that last week. Let's talk about our comic picks for this upcoming week. So I'm going to kick it back to Tia. What are you excited for this upcoming week?
It was kind of not super exciting week for my pull list. So one thing that I am excited about that we don't often talk about in this section of the podcast is a trade paperback, which is The Worst X-Men Ever. Trade paperback is finally coming out, and I've seen it and I've like flipped through the single issues and I was like, oh my god, like I love Michael Walsh so much, the art is amazing, and like it just looks like such a great story. I want to binge read this, but I also want to like savor it, so this is the sort of book that I need in trade paperback so I could just like read it in bed, as you know, from start to finish on a lazy Sunday, and I guess that's gonna be next Sunday, so yay.
Nice.
Yes,
that's super exciting, if only because I read it in single issues, and when it was coming out digitally it was coming out week after week, so I got a new episode or a new issue every week for 5 weeks, and oh my gosh.
Max so can Bemis. I ask you a quick question about that? Because I like, so Michael Walsh is one of my favorite artists and I have a lot of confidence in his abilities. Did you notice any like change in the quality of the art having to be churned out that fast?
No, actually, I think my guess is what Marvel does with these, for these digital first books where they release them week after week, they must have them done well in advance.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true.
Because this book, like, it came out every week, the quality was the same every week, and quite honestly, like, I don't know, like, I don't see how Marvel would think it'd be feasible for an artist to churn out a book every, I mean, they can't, they just can't, so it had to have been done well in advance, and it helps that this is a limited series that takes place outside of the normal continuity. It's just a nice little story that kind of features your favorite late 90s, or I guess 90s and 2000s X-Men. And this character who just tries to like experiment with being an X-Men. It's such a good book.
Yeah,
Max Bemis, like, to it. I don't even know what to say about that guy because like his writing is like very hit or miss for me. But this book, he nailed what it is to be an X-Men, and that's the most I could ask for a weird book like this. He totally totally understands it, so I got to credit him for that.
So it's a mini, right? This trade is like the complete collection of it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Cool. I might have to get that too.
It's like the only way I can handle X-Men stuff because I want to like X-Men. Like I want to like them.
I totally get it.
Yeah.
Anyways, Kate, what are you excited for this week?
I am looking forward to Faith number 2. And this is of the new ongoing run. Number 1, we had some pretty heavy foreshadowing of a possible costume redesign, which... holy cow, I really want this to happen. It's about time. We need to update Faith's look. But one of her coworkers, who now knows about her superhero identity kind of thing from the miniseries arc, is like, hey, you know, my girlfriend's really into cosplay, and she like improves upon costumes for some of the older characters, and you know, you could, you know, maybe she could help you out. I'm like, yes. So I'm really hoping we see that in number 2. Also, this comic is always just so much fun and beautiful and refreshing. So that's, whenever it's coming out, it's at my top of my read list. How about you, Mike?
Yeah, this week I have a pretty decent sized pull this week, but Invincible 130 I think is going to be my pick for this week, if only because this past week Robert Kirkman announced that Invincible is going to be ending at issue 144. So that's this is a series that's been going on for a little over 10 years, 13 years or something like that.
Wow.
And that's crazy. I've been reading it. I think I picked up the 6th trade when it came out. So I've been reading it for almost, you know, for probably a little, I don't know. I've been reading it for a very long time. Like, since I got into comics, this has been, like, one of my staples.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really bizarre to be able to say, I read this really long, ongoing book from beginning to end. And this isn't, like, I don't know. Like, this book is actually going to have a natural conclusion. At least, that's what Kirkman says. He's like, I could have kept it going, but I wanted to. This comic has constantly been about doing the exact opposite of what mainstream comics are doing. So like a lot of the book is commentary on mainstream superhero comics, but at the same time he tries to subvert all the classic tropes in really interesting ways, and I think he's done that a handful of times. and him saying, you know, this book could go on forever like all the other superhero books, but I want it to come to an end, is actually really cool.
Yeah.
And the fact that Ryan Ottley has been on this book since issue number 6, and he's going to be coming, continuing through issue 144 with like one or two breaks. I think Corey Walker, who did the first 6 issues of Invincible, has come in and done a couple of issues here and there, a couple of arcs here and there. But on the whole, it's been Ryan Ottley. So it'll be cool to see Ottley go out and do something else that will maybe be a miniseries or ongoing or his own work, like Grizzly Shark and Sea Bear and Grizzly
yes.
Shark is a thing that he's been doing, which is great. But yeah, I'm really excited. I think what Rick Kirkman's doing right now in Invincible has actually been very interesting, and to know that it's going to lead up to this big final Vultramite fight that has been kind of building since, I don't want to say like issue 80, maybe even earlier, is really, really cool. I'm really pumped for this issue this week.
Do you think that maybe one of the reasons he decided to end it is because, like, if his impetus for the book is to sort of critique or subvert superhero tropes, I feel like mainstream superhero comics are starting to do that themselves. So maybe he felt like there wasn't a need for him to do it with Invincible, or there wasn't like room for it anymore because, I don't know. What do you think?
That's actually an interesting thought. I never really considered it, but you are right. I think a lot of the things that Kirkman pointed out early on in the series have kind of gone away. And as other comic writers and other creators have realized, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this anymore. And a lot of his commentary was originally probably on like 80s and 90s comics. And to some point, you know, it was a little bit on modern, like 2000 era comics and all the crossovers. And he was constantly making fun of that.
But we could still make fun of that.
And yeah, but I think that's always going to be a thing, or at least it's going to be a thing for a while longer. But I don't think that's the point of Invincible. It was telling a compelling story while also trying to, you know, slap other comics in the face. And I think it's gotten to the point where he just wants to tell a good story, end it well, and say, look at this thing that I did for a while. That was an era in my life. And he's definitely doing that. I think he's going to walk away from Invincible with his head held high, given all the wild success he's had outside of this series, knowing that Invincible and Walking Dead really got him started.
Yeah.
But I love this book. This book is serious, like, of all the comics that I've read, and I love X-Men to death, Invincible really has been that book that I can say that I've never, outside of one time when I almost dropped it, that I was like, this, I can always say this book is fantastic. Like, this book is one of those comics that I recommend to people to get started in comics, because it's a superhero story, but you don't have to know anything, and it establishes everything, and there's enough to read to where you never run out, but it's digestible at the same time. So,
and it'll kind of teach you about the genre as it tells you a story. So
exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a good recommendation for newcomers.
I'm still really sad. I wish that they push it to 150. Like, and that's going to be
the next
2 years. It's going to be like, why couldn't they just push it 6 more issues or 12
even
more
just
issues?
Like 145. Like 144? Why?
Yeah, yeah. That's okay. I'm going to be, I think either way, I'm going to be happy with how it ends. For this week's episode, Kate had this idea a long time ago, and she threw into the master spreadsheet that I use for scheduling, saying, why don't we talk about superhero fashion and capes and tights and superhero costumes? And I don't really know what sparked it, but I think right before we got back from the break, she figured out why. So, Kate, what sparked this initial idea? Like, usually these types of topics come out of, like, one of us being angry about something, and we're like, we got to talk about
totally
this on the show.
Yep. It was definitely, I was rereading some Matt Fraction Hawkeye, the Lee Meyer Hawkeye. Whoever took over after him, and I've been grumpy about it, I don't remember. It was unmemorable. That's kind of the problem. But anyway, Kate Bishop's costume, otherwise completely fine and unobjectionable, has these god-awful cutouts in the shoulders and hips, which you never see this on male heroes. So why do ladies get this treatment? And as Tia was saying, McKelvey, our beautiful Jamie McKelvey, filled them in for us on Young Avengers, and it looks so much better. And so that got me thinking about superhero fashion, and because there's definitely guys that have some really awful costumes too. It's not
yeah,
just
yeah.
J- just the ladies that get screwed over sometimes. And then there's some awesome ones, and what makes one awesome and what some not, you know. And so I thought it'd be an interesting thing to talk about.
So cutouts are a no-go is what you're saying.
I'm not a fan of the cutouts.
Okay. I literally want to burn all of DC to the ground every time I see. Who's that? Is it Power Girl?
Power
the
Girl.
White leotard Power with Girl. The boob window? Like, get yeah. it the fuck together. Yeah. Okay, come on.
Hey, you know, like maybe she had a symbol on her shirt or on her chest.
And they ripped it off out of spite. Yeah.
Right? And instead of just ripping it off, they like just ripped the actual costume. No, that's not what happened. I'm certain that's not what happened.
DC is so far behind Marvel at this point for their female characters. It's getting embarrassing.
Like, I don't know if I mentioned this when we talked about controversy, but, you know, it's like everyone got really mad at the, like, panty shot that Frank Cho did for the variant cover for Wonder Woman. And while I totally am like grateful that it got shut down, also like maybe she shouldn't wear a bathing suit anymore. That could solve a lot of problems.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, just you know, I was always thinking about that. Like, what happened to the pants and the jeans? Like, wasn't she wearing jeans at
great.
One point?
Yeah, I loved.
I
jeans.
Thought that was a super she cool had, modern take
oh,
on Wonder
Odyssey
Woman.
That Odyssey run, whatever it was, Wonder Woman Odyssey or something like that. And she had the coolest outfit redesign. And then they're like, nope, back to the skirt. And why do we need these schoolgirl pleated skirts that are like 3 inches long?
Oh,
that's
my God, right?
Gotham
well,
Girl
you know
is
why.
Rocking that right now. Yeah. And I'm like, you're flying around in this, and it's just...
We all know why.
Well, that's...
It's
it
true.
Was really frustrating. Like, when I was doing a little bit of research about, like, why do superheroes have to wear capes and tights? And, like, you know, what are some of the ways that people who deal with comics in a kind of a scholarly way, like, how do they deal with these costumes? And basically, the research is, like... You know, oh, here it is. We're talking about superhero costumes, except none of this applies to women because they're a whole separate, like, clusterfuck of male gaze nonsense.
Yeah.
Well, that's something that's always been kind of weird. Like, when we think about, like, female costumes, it's like they always have to be wearing skirts because, like, a lot of the times when these characters were created, they were, you know, it was at a time when people were like, well, men wear pants and women don't wear pants, or at least... That's like what the terrible stereotype in my head is, right? So they'd always put them in skirts because typically they're like younger, or in the case of like Wonder Woman, like it's supposed to be like her quote unquote armor or something like that. But looking at like Supergirl, it was like, okay, you're the, you know, quote unquote, not really, but you're like the kid sister of Superman. So you're wearing a skirt because it implies young age, blah, blah, blah.
And also the feminized version of the dude.
Right, exactly.
Yes. Yes.
But in research of superhero costume history, it does seem that male superheroes' costumes do not conform to like the style of the day, but that women's costumes tended to take more cues from the women's fashions of the time.
Yeah, and that's true too for non-capes. That was one of the interesting things they talked about or are talking about. I haven't finished it yet in the Pretty in Ink, is how some of these women artists, if you look at their work and you could, it was just a style guide for the age, like, and a lot of them were also women's clothing designers and had their own lines and like imprints, or they're not called imprints for clothes, whatever you call it for clothing lines. So I think that's true, not just for capes.
Yeah. And it almost makes me think that maybe there was, you know, for male characters, it was easier to draw like tights and capes because you wouldn't have to draw as many lines. You would just have to put like a color on the person. But when it came to like women, it was we have to show some skin. We have to, you know, put them in a skirt or put them in a top that has like, you know, is showing their shoulders or showing their collarbones or something. And that to me seems like it would be harder to draw. So is it just about that the male gaze then at that point? I mean, that seems to be the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, with women, yes. With men, it's a little bit different. Researchers think that they have actually named the inspirations for the first super, like, costumed superhero that appears in Action Comics number one in 1938. And there were these two carnival strongmen. One was named Zygmunt Breitbart, and he was called, actually, his like, tagline was the Superman of the ages, and he wore this long red cape.
No way.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and his inspiration was like a Roman gladiatorial cape.
And so
another one of these strong men, his name was Eugene Shadow, and part of his act was that he would sort of be like one of the people in the crowd, and then he would come up and actually he was a strong man. So the idea of that like dual identity where he like takes off his civilian clothes and now he's in his strong man costume underneath and he's actually Superman or not really.
No way. I just think that's so funny because the Shadow and Superman both ended up being characters, mm-hmm. like popular comic book characters. And when I think of the Shadow, it's the hat with the domino mask and like a big black cape. You know, that's so bizarre that it came from like strongmen, like
of all things. So the tights and the underwear on the outside and all of that, I mean, that's directly coming from these carnival strongmen from the 1920s. And so there's this idea that what Superman or what superheroes do is a spectacle of physical labor. And so they need to be wearing costumes that emphasize their masculinity in terms of their strength and
showing off their muscles.
Right.
Thus the spandex.
And then you also get this idea that like a brightly colored spandex outfit is very conspicuous. And so there's also this aspect of like performative accountability because you can't hide in a bright red and blue spandex outfit.
Right.
So there's this idea that you're like a trusted figure because you're so out there and visible.
Huh, how interesting. Oh,
you're blowing my mind. See, if Paul was on the episode, he'd say, see, this all just ties back to wrestling.
No, I mean, he's not entirely yeah. wrong. He's really not. Especially because if you're talking about performing masculinity, it's inherently a contest, right? Like, and so where female costumes are really kind of circumscribed by the male gaze, these male costumes have to emphasize, you know, how strong they are over other men.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This is deconstructing all of comic books, and now I have to like reevaluate everything in my whole life.
Well, so here I'm going to blow your mind one, just a little bit more.
Oh, please, great.
Because if you look at characters like X-Men, a lot of them can't have the dual identity that someone like Superman can have because their otherness and their superness is like actually part of their physical bodies.
Right.
So like there's an interesting aspect of it where there's like a construction of identity, you know, like the moment that you acquire your superhero costume is really important to your superhero's origin story. Mm-hmm. And you have, in some cases, the costume actually gives you powers like Iron Man, or there are multiple people who will take up the guise by wearing the costume. Like there's a million Batgirls. Different Thors and so on and so forth. But then there's characters like X-Men who often like they can't take it off.
Right. And that's really interesting because I think that at one point, you know, and I think it's still a thing where the X-Men, you're not really considered part of the team yet. You're not like really a superhero until you've been given a costume, or nowadays it's more like when you've been given a code name because the X-Mansion gets attacked so often that it's like we're all X-Men technically, but you're not really a part of the team until you've been given a code name, and that is then just an oral way of confirming that someone is now part of this team, can be a superhero that goes out and does superhero things. That's oh man, but this whole costume thing is blowing my mind. I can't even think about it.
Yeah.
I mean,
so I've heard the thing about, you know, so often that's the excuse that gets thrown out for women in skirts, though, is that, oh, well, that's the way it was back then. And that, you know, that kind of thing. I'm like, yeah, but that was how many decades ago, and we know better now. And some artists are doing much better now by their characters. Like, I know we bashed on DC, but Batwoman is one of my favorite female costumes because it's... Mm-hmm. It is awesome and iconic, but also totally, like, realistic. Like, someone could actually fight in it. Like, she's not wearing high heels.
And I also don't actually buy that it's true that it's just a product of a bygone age.
Yeah. Because,
I mean, like, women in the 40s wore pants. They were Rosie the Riveter, exactly, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, there's a Bedside Press, I guess, founder Hope Nicholson. She's really into, like, the history of superheroines. And she would definitely be one to ask about this, because I think that it's actually... it's not reflecting reality, and it's reflecting a fantasy.
Yeah, exactly.
Of the time.
What they wanted. Yeah. Which I think is true now, too. I mean.
Yeah, yeah. I think that audiences now expect a little bit more reality to suspend their disbelief. And so you've definitely seen costumes shift toward kind of something that is like more functional in the real world.
Yeah, that's Batgirl of Bedside, or Batgirl of, I want to say Bed-Stuy, because it's supposed to be that in New York, but it's Burnside. Thank you. It's Bed-Stuy. That's what it's supposed to be in New York. Yeah. That's actually a neighborhood, so come on.
I didn't know that.
But, yeah.
That's where Hawkeye lives.
Yeah. You know, actually, rereading that book, I was laughing my ass off, because now that I live in New York, I totally get all these references, and it's totally true. But anyways, back to costumes.
There are real-life costumed social activists like Pussy Riot or the Gorilla Girls,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
There's also costumed supervillains like the KKK.
Yep.
Well, yes. I mean, but if we look at all of those, I guess, real life superheroes, we do see the same kind of standout, very obvious, like, look at me kind of styles, right? Like, for instance, to go back to the KKK, probably one of the most iconic, like, hate groups in America, you know that they're the KKK because they're wearing that costume, right? You know that Pussy Riot is Pussy Riot because they're probably naked and screaming a lot, but...
Well, they also do a costume that I think it's like a brightly colored babushka type outfit.
Oh, yeah.
But there is the idea of, like... concealing your civilian identity, and you put on this costume and you take on another identity, but it's also still part of you, like that Oscar Wilde quote, give a man a mask and he'll tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The idea of ritual masks and costumes and carnival, I mean, this goes back centuries in Western culture, and certainly non-Western cultures have a tradition of, like, you know, shamanistic masks, or like using them for various purposes,
right,
and rituals and things. So there's definitely a lot of history that is kind of supporting the idea that a superhero would have to put on something radically different from their civilian identity to become a superhero, and possibly change, like possibly even obscuring that civilian identity.
I think too, at a much more concrete, practical level for readers, especially back when the print quality wasn't as great, but even now, especially like in X-Men comics where there's so many characters, costumes help a lot to differentiate characters and make them
absolutely
easily recognizable off the page. Even for, there's some artists, you know, who draw faces pretty much all the same and body types the same. And so it makes it easy to tell who's who. And between
artists.
Especially
in like a splash page battle.
Right, exactly. And like between artists, when you have different artists on books and stuff, like you still know that this is the Superman or the Batman, you know, like that kind of thing. Even if they have pretty divergent art styles. Plus, it has all the cosplay fun.
So that's actually a really interesting point, because so the hardest costume I've ever built is Angela, which is like a space bikini with thigh-high metal boots. And
space bikini.
I'm here to tell you that there is no material in existence that can behave the way the material her boots are made of behaves in the comics.
Well,
that's because it's made of adamantium,
space,
right? And it's space metal.
Yeah.
And
jeez,
so
Tia.
They're really empowering to wear, and like figuring it out is this whole, I think, really deep engagement with the character and their stories. But like, yeah, these things they're not real. They can't be real. So in that sense, you kind of can, if it didn't have all the horrible sexism associated with it, you could kind of be like, well, sure, maybe she can wear heels and have like all of her visceral organs exposed because she's super and nothing can get her.
Except. I'd buy that if they did the same thing to guys. but they don't.
Exactly. Like, oh my God, you
have all this reasoning for why we need to be able to see both the full chest and full backside and how this person could do it because they're a gymnast and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, fine, give that to me in the male gymnast and I'll believe you. Give me both Batman's pecs and both his butt cheeks and I'll believe you. Would you do it to him?
For everybody. Yeah,
exactly.
That's why the Hawkeye Initiative is so spectacular.
I know. I love it so much.
Yeah, that was... I imagine that's still going on. Yeah, it is. Like, all the Hawkeye stuff. I just remember when that was, like, rising. It was so crazy to see the number of superheroes that they were just trying to show, like, how impractical costumes are, like, on men. Because it's...
Well, and it's absurd. How people don't see it as ridiculous until you put it on the guy. And then they're like, oh, that is ridiculous.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, that's what I meant.
The poses
and
stuff.
Yeah.
The same thing for, like, they've done in other genres. So, like, for commercials, there's people who remake sexist commercials with a man as the person talking about his, you know, trouble keeping his house clean and blah, 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 and, like, how ridiculous it is. And do it, like... word for word, shot for shot, and people are like, that's completely ridiculous. And that's the point. You don't see it as ridiculous when you're so conditioned to be accepting that of women. And then so
I just laughed really hard because me and Mike during the break were just talking about how his partner has been away and he had to like frantically clean up the house before she comes home tonight.
Yeah, because I turned into just a trash person where I literally, like, there were comics in 6 or 7 different places where I would find myself. So, like, yesterday I took, like, a series of naps throughout the day. And I...
Oh, no.
So, in each of those places, though, there was some way that I could just reach, like, within arm's length, and there would be a comic book available, whether it was, like, a trade or a volume of a manga or my iPad or my computer. Like...
Oh, Mike, you beautiful mess.
I know. I
just spent like 2 hours cleaning today. Yeah. So it was just a whole problem. But back to costumes again.
What are some good costumes
that don't make you
angry?
Outside of Batwoman.
Yeah, okay. The Mighty Thor right now, Dr. Jane Foster's version of it, is awesome. And
Except that she still has armor boobs.
Wait, what? No, she doesn't.
Wait, but
what
are you
talking about?
So, okay, hold on a second.
Crap,
hold
then
on.
Take it off my
In
list.
Regards In regards to the armor boobs,
I thought she had like a full breastplate though. Doesn't
but
she?
But they're still molded as boobs.
Oh, that's true.
And well, like, what?
How
happens...
else are you gonna deal with that then? If I guess I don't know. As a person who doesn't have breasts,
you just wear a regular breastplate. Because the problem with if you mold the boob cups into a breastplate, it weakens the like metal at the point between your boobs, which is like where some really important stuff is in your insides.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so if you get it hit in the chest, it's more likely that it's going to fail and kill you.
Anytime you have boob pockets, which is essentially what that ends up being, whether it's a spandex costume or like if it doesn't turn into a uniboob, that's because there's boob pockets and that's just ridiculous.
Basically, every female superhero should have a uniboob because that's how your boobs look in athletic wear.
Yeah. Like Captain Marvel right now, the current Captain Marvel is perfect.
Yes. She wears a sports bra. Thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chris Anka, so
like,
much.
Like you would actually do if you were running around as a female doing athletic things. Yeah.
Right. That makes sense. I was just curious. I was like, I wasn't sure like if that was like necessary. I mean, I guess should there be like a bump at all in metal like that? Or should it just be like flat all the way down?
It should be the same as a dude's.
Okay. I mean, you do see guys.
I didn't
know
that from an armor standpoint.
You do see like male armor that has like the pecs, like Batman's suit sometimes has like the pecs built in.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
get bat nipples at one point?
Oh my god!
Well, that was in the movies. That was in the movies.
Oh dear.
But like, you look at someone like, you know, I think a lot of the X-Men costumes are terrible and problematic. But then you get some characters who have like who are actually wearing practical like costumes such as like X-23. She wears like a spandex suit that like
costume.
Works really well. And yeah, her latest costume, like as Wolverine, like as she's holding the, you know, the Wolverine mantle, like has totally worked because it's the same as Wolverine's, like as same as Logan's, but it's just her like a person inside of that, so her body shape fits inside of that like spandex or whatever it's made out of. But then you look at someone like an Emma Frost, or you look at a Magic, or you look at, I don't know, Jean Grey's was never really so bad, but it was just spandex with a skirt for a while, and then it just became a full like bodysuit, and all the X-Men were wearing bodysuits. But you know, those people, they change their costumes, you know, with the day of the week.
Well, and but, the, and like with the different X lines, because there's always a couple going at once.
Yeah.
I thought Miss Marvel's is a really good example of how you can have a unique costume that's like, it includes her heritage and like is a nod to who she is without being like super over the top. Like, I'm not articulating this well at all, but I really like her costume and think it works well for her.
Yeah, I actually think Miss Marvel's costume holds like really well to the history of the character as well.
Yeah.
Like it still has the, it still has the stripe, it still has like the same top, but she's wearing pants, which I always thought was like perfect. It's like, why wasn't, you know,
put on some pants,
right?
Yeah, why wasn't Carol Danvers wearing pants?
Are you jumping over people? You probably don't want a skirt on.
The thing, Miss Marvel never wore a skirt, she wore like a bathing suit.
Yeah,
and so she had her legs exposed and she wore like a scarf around her waist,
like the Psylocke look. Yeah.
Yeah, the Psylocke is a whole...
Yeah, extra awful.
I will say, I think the latest Psylocke, she's wearing pants, if I remember correctly, but I don't know.
Listen, okay, there's no way you're not getting a front wedgie in a costume cut
so
that
true.
High if you're Psylocke and kicking your legs around like she does.
Yeah.
For guys, I really like... This will come as a big shock to you guys. The current run of Vision is so perfect.
Vision is problematic, though, because he is always the Vision, right?
I guess it's not a costume, like, you're right. It's who he is.
Right. Yes, I mean, not to poop on your parade there.
But wait, hold on. They totally, like, in the movies, they made him, like...
Dad sweater.
Didn't they make him all red in the movie?
Yeah, they did.
And they made him, like, the tomato.
Yeah, he's, like, tomato red. He has, like, this weird
fake skin. So there's different versions. I don't know. I do like when it's very iconic. Like, if you can give me a minimalist graphic design version and I know exactly who it is just looking at that, then that's, like, so perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's really a part of what the costume is supposed to do.
Being iconic.
Yeah, it's like their brand in a way.
Right.
So it can't be too complicated.
So we've trashed on some female costumes. Are there any guy costumes that we have a problem with? I feel like there's definitely less of them because none instantly
Superman,
come to mind.
I think Superman's costume is problematic.
Undies on the outside?
Yeah, I don't really think that's a good
outdated.
Costume.
It's outdated for sure.
Well, and the Superman, like, Man of Steel costume where it's just like this blue-red amalgam thing that comes up and then there's like a bulge and then there's like the rest of his body. I don't know. Seems like he needs to fix that or something. I don't know how you fix it, because a lot of male superheroes are just like, I'm in a unitard, like Quicksilver, North Star, I mean for the Flash, and of course I name all three speedsters, and of course they would want minimal costume because they have to run fast, but
they should.
Chafing is a real problem, come on. When you're going that fast.
They get around that in the Flash TV show.
They
saying
do.
That
they
the
talk about
the
it.
Costume that they wear, blah, blah, blah,
Otherwise, it would, like, catch on fire in a really unoptimal place.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I don't know, you guys. I feel like I don't notice male superhero costumes as much because they don't like ping all of my offended.
Well, because they're not offensive
buttons.
Generally.
Yeah,
yeah.
They're just,
if they're bad, it's just like, oh, that's kind of ugly, or you know, it's not like, oh, that's offensive.
But like they blend into the character more, I think, so that like I acknowledge, like when I see them, I'm like, that's so and so, but they're not jarring in a way that calls them out to me.
Right.
Like, they just are part of the story, and I think that is kind of what costumes should be. They should just be part of the story.
Yeah.
I was going to mention Black Widow earlier because I think that her costume works and it's identifiable enough to where you're lady in all black. She's got these things, these pouches around her waist, and she's got these
belt.
Shooters on her arm or like these little shooters on her wrists. Like,
and
that's all
hair.
I need to know. And red hair. Yeah. comic books love red hair. That's because it sticks out, and that's another one of those things where it's like that character is wearing a bright color, which happens to be their hair, so therefore we recognize them as that character. But then, you know, you put Miss Marvel, Black Widow, you put Jean Grey, you put I can't think of any other red-haired female characters in a line, and you go, who is that? You know?
Yeah.
So I always am curious, like, So working with these fabrics is not easy unless you have a lot of experience and access to a serger. And like, they're not easy to keep clean, and like, probably they get destroyed a lot. So who's making superhero costumes, and who is the superhero dry cleaner?
There's like, okay. a really them? Super seamstress out there.
Here is why you should all read Invincible.
Okay.
So at one point in the story, Invincible gets his superpowers. You know, it's very early on in the story, he gets his superpowers, and his dad, who is a superhero as well, he says, you know what, I'm going to introduce you to my guy. And his guy is this old man in his like 50s who makes all the superhero costumes in the city. Like, and that's his thing. He makes them out of the super indestructible fabrics. He makes them in all different colors, shapes, sizes, whatever you want. And he does it for everybody. And so multiple times throughout the story, Mark goes to this guy and he gets his costume updated, gets his costume fixed after a bad fight. And other superheroes do the exact same thing. It's like, it's answering that stupid question that we all have about other superheroes. It's fantastic.
I don't care what universe you're in. I'm just envisioning the lady from The Incredibles that...
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
No
yes.
cakes.
She
no
also
cakes.
Makes them. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's like they must get smelly. Like yeah. you're working out and I don't know.
Super sweat doesn't smell to you. Come on.
Well, especially not ladies because they're not wearing enough clothes.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So the one, I guess, last bit is... So, Kate, you were talking about the fixing of Faith's character's
yeah.
costume. And I wanted to touch on that because I think it's kind of a big deal. Like, why is it... What makes this costume so bad for you? And what are you hoping to see in the next version of her costume?
This isn't one that's offensive in any way. It's just so ugly that I'm like, come on. She deserves so much
better than
this.
Okay.
So she has... For those of you who haven't read it, Faith runs around in what is essentially a half coat, half smock looking number with underneath it is like a white shirt, white pants and white boots, which comes across as kind of a unitard snowsuit look. And then the whole ensemble is white with like a light blue trim, which, you know, a la toothpaste colors.
Sure.
And she's like so hip and fun in the rest of the book. It just doesn't make sense at this point. Like, she's so much better than this. And the character herself wouldn't be comfortable with it. Like, she's trendier than this, which is kind of what they get at in number one, is the guy's like, you can do better than this. And she's like, I can do better than this.
The only pass that I'll give them for this is that, like, you know, Faith is a really important book in terms of body diversity mm-hmm. and representing a plus size woman. And plus size women, I think, have a really hard time finding trendy,
right.
beautiful clothes. And so maybe they can turn this into like a moment of authenticity of that perspective where it's like, you know, like, can I please just get like a nice superhero costume like the skinny superheroes? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if they can turn it into that kind of moment, then I will accept the ugly costume as necessary to like insert this moment of experience that I think probably every plus size woman has had.
I think the real pass for it is that this is Valiant and they just have a lot of ugly costumes in general in their universe. It's not like hers is unique and poorly done. Like, it's like, no, it's bad. And the thing with the clothes too, like in a lot of, especially in her fantasy sequences that, Margaret Savage, or however you pronounce her name, does. She has really cool, trendy clothes on and stuff. So she, like, it's not that they're not there. I think as interesting as it would be to have her have that commentary about the clothes and stuff, part of what makes it so exciting, the comic itself, is that her weight is a non-issue. Like, they don't make it about her weight at all, which is kind of super awesome. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? Like,
but
she's not a fat hero, she's just a hero.
No, I get that. And but at the same time, like, I always find it a little bit disingenuous when stuff like that is avoided, because if you're really writing an authentic character,
mm-hmm.
like, that is going to be a part of her life and a part of her experience. So, like, you know, it always creeps me out when it's like, oh, this character is non-white, but you would never know it.
Right,
and it's
exactly.
like, well, but like, yeah. it kind of is important.
Yep. So that's true. That's a good point.
I think there's an incredibly, incredibly fine line to walk on that then. Because it's one thing to bring it up in the story naturally, and it's another thing to try to discuss it in a way that isn't going to be, you know, problematic for readers to say, like, you know, they just added a scene in there to make us aware of it. It's like, I don't know, like, it's one of those things where you already are aware of it as a reader, so that they don't maybe they don't need to bring it up. But again, I go back and forth 100 times on this, because it's important to bring it up, but at the same time, you don't want to, like, smash it in your reader's face and say, like, did you know? Did you realize this? It's like,
yeah,
I did.
I think this would be an organic way to fit it into
I think you're right.
Okay. Story.
Yeah, in this specific case, I absolutely agree there.
Although, you don't really go shopping for one of these suits, do you? You have one made. Right. So it sounds like maybe coworker's girlfriend's going to whip something up for her. So
well but see. Like, did you see all the drama where Leslie Jones was trying to get a dress for, I think, like, a premiere? I mean, so, like, even when you're getting stuff made for you, it's not easy.
It's true. Poor Leslie Jones. Yeah, but she gets so much crap.
But I think the most resourceful people in the world are cosplayers. I don't think there's, like, a question of, like, can a cosplayer do that? It's like, no, a cosplayer will do that. It's not a question of if.
Cosplayers will do anything.
Yeah. I mean, you got to credit people who go out there and dress up, because they will find a way to make themselves look like the character they want to look like. They have that dedication, something that's true. I don't think I will ever, ever have in my entire life, because, like, it's one of those things, like, 10,000 hours to be great at something. It's like cosplayers, it's like 10,000 cosplays to be great at something. That's an absurd number, but it's noble, I have to say. The amount of dedication is unbelievable.
I didn't eat carbs for like a year so I could be Angela.
Oh, that doesn't sound worth it at all. Carbs are delicious.
Let me go back to my bagel stacked with bread sandwich.
Right,
hold on.
Exactly.
I don't know. Costumes are really interesting. I think we've seen an evolution of them over, especially the last 10 years, right? With the number of relaunches that we've seen, especially the big two, with Valiant coming back and trying to modernize their characters from the 90s. Obviously, I think DC's kind of stepping backwards in some ways, while stepping forward in other areas. Like, they are far behind Marvel in a lot of ways in that sense.
Dynamite's done a great job with, like, Vampirella and Deja Thoris, like, yes. Has something besides pasties now.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
It's true. How do you guys feel about some of these costume redesigns in comics to match what's on TV now or in movies?
I like it, because part of the reason why I have a hard time getting into certain characters is that I just find their costumes ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the movies, I think Marvel more than DC, they try to make more sense in the real world. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
I can go either way with it, because I would not read X-Men if they look like the Bryan Singer X-Men movies. But at the same time, I really like what they did in First Class with the costumes, because they felt like the traditional, like, 60s X-Men characters. I thought that was really cool. It was like a bold choice to put a bunch of kids in bright yellow spandex. And it worked for me as far as, you know, an X-Men fan goes. But I don't think that I don't think it works for every series. I think it works for some. Like, for instance, The Flash or Superman or Batman, maybe. But maybe not so much like X-Men or, I want to say, Avengers in some ways, but like Avengers even match pretty well. I think that the movies did a good job of capturing those character styles, like especially Captain America. Like some of the costumes he wore were like pulled straight out of comic books. Like the Ed Brubaker Winter Soldier series was what Cap wore in Winter Soldier. Like you can't get much better than that.
But I think like they really had their work cut out for them with Thor and Loki. And I think that the movies did a really nice job.
Yeah. You know, Lady Sif.
Oh, Lady Sif.
She wore pants, didn't she?
She wore pants with a little skirt, and she also wore wedge heels, and the actress broke her fucking back in filming the second movie.
Seriously?
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know she was in heels. Oh, okay.
She's fine.
Whew.
But the reason why Lady Sif is not much in the sequel, what's that one? The Dark World.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's because she got hurt.
How did she break her back?
She fell.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. Wearing heels. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, like wedge heels. Like, if you look at a lot of the extra footage or like unedited footage. Uh-huh. You know, a lot of times you'll see the character, the women characters wearing just like not their costume shoes if the shot's going to be like from the waist up or whatever.
Right.
But recently some stunt woman spoke out about how their job is like a million times more dangerous than right. their male counterparts because they can't wear pads and they can't, and they usually are wearing heels because, you know, their costumes are what they are. So when they do these falls and things, like their dudes will have like tons of padding on under their clothes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not wild. Fair.
I was reading when I was, I want to plug this book. If anyone's interested, it was, in my opinion, the most interesting mix of like history, but also analysis of superhero costumes. Mm-hmm. It's called The Superhero Costume, Identity and Disguise in Fact and Fiction. It's by Barbara Browning and Danny Graydon, and it was really good, so I recommend it. And they were talking in the book about how, I think it was the Michael Keaton Batman, like, the costume was really hard to move in, and so a lot of the stiffness of the character, and, like, where he has to turn his whole body to, like, look to the side, but, like, that, you know, it informed, like, the way that he like conceived of the character of Batman, you know? Mm-hmm. So the costume can also inform how you inflect a performance or how you construct a character's like gestures and idiosyncratic like movements because they have to respond to a cape or a cowl or something that's physically limiting them.
Hmm. Huh, that's interesting.
I will definitely drop a link to that in the show notes. That sounds like a very, very interesting read. And it's funny that you mentioned that about the Michael Keaton, because like all I can think of is that scene where he's sitting in the Batmobile and someone says something, and he has to turn his whole body to just to like nod at them.
Yeah.
And
they call it, like, in the book, they call it, in quotes, the bat turn.
Yes. Well, and that, you know, it's funny you say that, because that was a point in the Christopher Nolan movies. At one point, like, you know, the character is fighting some guys and he comes back to the Batcave and he says, "This is way too stiff. We have to fix it." And I guess maybe that was like a callback to that original suit.
Or like Ryan Reynolds in Deadpool, where he's like, "No, please don't put me in a green suit," because that like monstrous CGI nightmare suit from Green Lantern was just so not anything good.
So in the not superhero but totally nerd related, in the extras for Game of Thrones, they talk about the actors who play the various like Kingsguard and other like knight types talk about how like they literally can't move in any scene, and that's frequently how a scene gets like you have to do another take, is because someone like moved just a fraction, because with all their armor, especially the chainmail, if they move even a tiny bit, it jingles and jangles like jingle bells, and so they have to be perfectly stone still through the whole shot, and so they're like, literally, I just stand in place and sometimes say a line. Like, you can't move.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm.
Cosplayers can do anything. I'm just gonna say that, like, you know,
it's true. It's
I just want to reiterate that point out of nowhere.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. Special thanks this week to Kate Scotchless and Tia Vasiliou. The music in this episode is brought to you by Poldor and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Poldor on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/Poldor. And more Infinity Shred can be found at infinityshred.com. If you enjoyed this show, tell someone about it, rate us online, or write to us. Tell us about your favorite and least favorite superhero costumes by email at ircb@destroythesaib.org. You can find the entire podcast team on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. Don't forget, you can comment on each episode and ask us questions on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. Until next time, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
Kate, I'm glad you brought up that thing about Faith. I didn't realize that there was a costume change actually upcoming.
Well, it's foreshadowing, so who knows?
Foreshadowing.
But why else would they do it so heavy? You know what I mean? Like, plus, there's been so much media critique of her costume that I feel like they're like, we get the message, we're gonna do it. So
really,
yeah.
I mean, the costume is hideous.
It is So bad. And so when Faith got so much coverage because of how well it sold and all the body positivity stuff, that was part of a lot of the reviewers things like, this is great, except this one thing. Why is she wearing a tarp? You know, like
so. A white tarp. Yeah,
of all things. With a snowsuit underneath. It's cool.
Yeah, it was so dumb.
Okay, that I will say I never understood. Like, I understand the cape, but like it did seem like she was wearing like snow pants. like a snow pants, yep. onesie thing that like yep.
Like the thing you just take off as soon as you get on this school bus before your friends at school can see it. Like
Right. You're like, I know
no
my mom
idea
wanted
what
to
you're
be
talking
warm.
About.
Oh, okay. See, you didn't live in Michigan. You didn't live in the Midwest where everything is fucking awful for 6 months out of the year.
Your mom won't let you stand at the bus stop freezing to death, so you have to leave the house in your snowsuit, but you're so embarrassed you take it off on the bus so that you get off at school.
But then, like, what do you do
have
with
you ever
it?
Seen,
you stuff it in your backpack, your secret puffy shame.
Yeah. You're like, yeah. It's
secret
true.
Puffy shame has to be the title of this episode.
See, have you ever seen the movie Christmas Story?
Yeah.
Okay, so you remember Ralphie's brother gets like, he gets wrapped up by his mom?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that shit actually happens in Michigan. Yep. Like,
oh my God.
In parts of Michigan, parts of Minnesota, Wisconsin, like kids will go out to the bus stop waiting dressed up like that. Because it is that cold, and two, parents are fucking insane. And they're like, well, you know, when I went to school in elementary school, I just wore a jacket and a small scarf. But my kids, they don't understand how cold it is, so I'm going to have to wrap them up.
Well, part of it, in parents' defense here, like part of it is the bus can be so sporadic because it gets like if it's icy or like snow and stuff, they might get stuck. And so the bus is supposed to get there
like
at 6:30 in the
minutes.
Morning, but it might be there at like 7:15. So how That's long true. Is your kid standing in -5 or -10?
You guys,
because it's really nice to be able to drive to the beach.
Tell you about a beautiful place where this never happens.
Oh, the concrete jungle? That sounds awful.
No, Tia
the concrete
the
jungle is hell.
Oh,
hell.
Where are you talking about?
I'm talking about the mythic Pacific coast.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Xander, slow it down. Xander goes on and on about California all the time, about how Michigan's always like 7 years behind, and actually having moved to New York, Michigan is totally 7 years behind on everything. But the Pacific coast, please tell us more about this magnificent, magical place.
No one ever makes you wear puffy shame, and buses do not get stuck places full of children on the way to school.
This is true.
I mean, you might like burn up in a forest fire or fall into the ocean when the big earthquake comes, but like until then, it's great.
We have I'm really into craft beer hipsters, but we don't have like the overrun cities of them though. One of my friends just moved to Seattle and he's like, you won't believe this. My fiance just became a barista. It's the worst. How did this happen?
Yeah.
So. See, I think what it is about like places like Michigan, like the North Midwest, is that we like, and I say we because I still consider myself a person who lives there. We like known challenges. Like every year we know winter's gonna be bad. We know the first 2 weeks of snow, everyone's gonna forget how to drive. We know that we're gonna have to bundle up. We're gonna have to completely change out our wardrobes and our dressers and stuff. We're gonna have to put on all the warmest clothes. Everything's gonna be wet, and then after that it's gonna be fine. But you know, we've got to live with that for about 6 to 7 months, and then when it warms up we can drive to the beach, which is, you know, 30 minutes away,
right,
to the nice freshwater beach with full of very clean water.
Yeah,
whereas if you're living in like, you know, if you're living in California, you're like, at any moment there could be an earthquake where everyone dies. And while that's like never going to happen, it's still just like a looming cloud of uncertainty.
It's going to happen. Also, there isn't any water.
Okay, and there's no water. See, Michigan, tons of water.
Yeah,
we have four big bodies of water that touch every side of our state.
Well,
it's fantastic.
And just a billion lakes inland, so.
Yeah.
And yet, some people have to drink poison water.
It's true.
Well, okay, that's true.